Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Broadway Podcast Network presents Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods, with me, Ben Rimmelauer. Today's guest, Steve Sacklad, assistant to the set designer.
Once upon a time.
Steve Sacklad was an assistant to set designer Tony Strages on the original Broadway production of Into the Woods. He also assisted the set designers on several other Broadway shows, including The Phantom of the Opera, La Cage aux Folles, Starlight Express, Legs Diamond, and Brighton Beach Memoirs. He later went on to a very successful career as the production designer responsible for such films as the 2011 musical reboot of The Muppets, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, Juno, Up in the Air, Drag Me to Hell, 22 Jump Street, and Chippendale Rescue Rangers, to name but a few. He studied at the Yale School of Drama.
My connection to Into the Woods was short-lived, as you know. I was just sort of a hired gun come in to get the draftings ready for the final bids. So they had already done the show in La Jolla, I believe, and they had modified the design for Broadway. And Tony Strages was out in his, you know, one-room studio / apartment in Brooklyn. And the process is he and his assistants would be building these beautiful model pieces. And then just before the show goes to bid for, all the different production houses to bid on building the show, the sort of definitive draftings have to be created. And usually they're done in a great hurry. And there's a flurry of hiring more guys, more folks to draft what has already been completed as a model piece. So I came in and worked just 2 weeks, as I recall. I guess it would have been in 86. And there were a few pieces that were finished model bits that I was going to just commit to draftings that were, you know, half inch to the foot or three quarters to the inch to the foot, detailed drawings of finished pieces. And then there was one unit which had yet to be designed, and that was Rapunzel's Tower, which was great fun. Tony had stacks and stacks of research books. This is back in the mid 80s, so there was no, of course, there's no internet, but there was no real tear sheets the way we would do collages of research now. So like every show, we had stacks and stacks of research books taken out from the public library, or out of Tony's own collection, all page marked. This, I think, predated Post-its even. So, you know, there'd be slub cards set into, 80 different pages in a given book. But he had these fantastic images of French chateau. And we sort of culled from those his favorite bits. And he had done a very quick, croaky kind of sketch of what he wanted. But he had this great idea for the tower to be in three cylinders that segmented and would telescope one into the other, so that the tower could actually grow from the deck upward into the sky. And out of the topmost tower section, there was a little Gothic window where you saw Rapunzel, who was singing her sort of plaintive Sondheim, you know, melody that was the sort of oral spine of Into the Woods. And so we scribbled together for a little bit, and then I started drafting, and ended up that was what I spent most of my time doing there, and a little give and take, a little back and forth, and we got the draftings to a point where then model makers could go take what I had done and turn it into a model for the final show and tell. I gotta say, I'm terrible at model making. I tried, but I knew this was not my strong suit. But I was really quick at drafting, and had an eye for doing sort of dimensional stuff, sculptural stuff, really well. I'm quick on my feet with a drafting pencil, and sort of love doing organic shapes and shapes that are not necessarily done with a straight edge and a you know, the parallel rule. But this tower piece was wonderful for that. And Tony had a great idea for this beautiful Gothic tracery built into the stonework, and a kind of parapet that was true sort of 15th century chateau design. And we got all of those bits into, you know, this one single a tower. And then there was the physical need for the witch to climb up the tower to reach her in the castle window. So also one of the layers of the drafting was the metal framework of ivy that sort of spiraled around the castle tower pieces that allowed it to be climbable, which was its own drafting piece. But I remember seeing the model come together as I'd moved on to draft other things, and to see the model sort of make it flesh, and there was sort of a rotating piece that rotated around to present the ivy lattice work. It was pretty great to see. And of course, Tony hand painted all of the models himself. He was very much about the tangible sculpting of these pieces, and then the painting of them was a sort of very unique stippled technique that was Tony's own. I'll back up for a second. I had met Tony Strages, 8 or 9 years earlier. He was a graduate of Yale Drama School. I was a first year student at Yale Drama School, and he'd come back to design beautiful set for Tales of the Vienna Woods, which is this very abstract piece with birch trees arcing across the stage, and this sort of white on white sculptural shutter cityscape with pieces that moved. And he had us build up the textures on these sculptural architectural pieces, and then overglaze them with radiant tones, and then overglaze that with white so that it was a white set with this gorgeous shimmery undertones. And when the lighting designer washed it with blues or greens or oranges, all those colors came out. And he was doing something similar painting wise on these set pieces that seemed to be one color, but the technique for getting them to that one color was a sort of wonderful undercoat of radiance, and then a sort of more neutral tone glazed on top of it all. So I could watch Tony hand painting that, and he was he was a great teacher. He would share what he was doing, and he would share how we should sort of work our way into his vision. And so 7 years, 8 years later, it wasn't from zero. When I first met Tony Strages, we had a little bit of a working knowledge of each other. And by this point I was sort of an accomplished draftsman in Broadway. And in fact, I think right after I finished a couple of weeks at Into the Woods, I went on and drafted for a couple of weeks on Phantom of the Opera, the other giant show that was sort of going to bid at the same time. And I was the first assistant on some shows. My pride of place was I'd been the first assistant on La Cage aux Folles back in 82-83. Done a whole bunch of David Mitchell shows after that. And the last David Mitchell show, I think, was in 89, which was the super famous Legs Diamond fiasco.
Oh, Peter Allen.
Yes, but I spent 7 or 8 months on as the first assistant on that show trying to make that thing work. but these jobs for Phantom of the Opera, Tony, for Into the Woods, were just bread and butter. And I was one of several people who were in just to get these draftings finished. I know I drafted on the Cinderella stepsisters, the carriage that would carry them to the ball. the little horses and this beautiful kind of skeletal carriage, true 18th century carriage, but sort of simplified into this elegant set piece. So I drafted that piece. And then I drafted a few of these surreal alien kind of plant life pieces that Tony designed as foreground. There were these 4 or 5 foot tall sort of giant bulb shapes on stems with long leaves that it just made sort of a ground row in effect certain ones of his forest look. But those were finished model pieces already, and I was simply recording them into, you know, a piece of drafting that the set shops could measure and bid on and then build from.
Okay, that's fascinating. You've given me so many more questions. I just, okay, just randomly something detailed just because it peaked. I don't want to forget it. I'm not, this might be a dumb question, but you weren't doing that undertone layering color on the model though, right? That was just what would be done on the actual set piece.
That was, I'm flashing back to the Tales from the of the Vienna Woods set that I, yeah. when I was painting for Tony at Yale, he did do, there was definitely a sense when he was painting the model of Into the Woods, similarly to what he had done on Sunny in the Park, where there was a sort of stippled color put on the piece. It was sealed, and then there was an overglaze to the local color that it was the final look. Because it was such a set that was, it was so not a specific world. It was almost abstract sculpture, that set, that sort of the laciness of the profiles that became that sort of tree silhouette. Panels of tree silhouettes and the decking that was, it was all a kind of sculpture that could be anywhere, but it wasn't even real. It wasn't green. It wasn't verdant. It wasn't soft in a way you think of a woods. It was this very brittle sculptural piece. So I think he was painting it more like a piece of fine art than anything, you know, that was sort of resemble real greenery.
And then I'm so interested that you said a 15th century chateau as a sort of inspiration for Rapunzel's tower. And then you, I noticed you specifically said an 18th century, carriage.
Yeah, it's true. I think they were very deliberate. They certainly were with the wardrobe, to keep this timeless, to keep this not locked into one exact year in, you know, all of the history of fairy tales. I think they wanted to be a merging of things. And I think in the costumes, you know, Van Hul Ward and Pat Ziprat, you see that really well because there's so much pulling from Bruegel and pulling from earlier, the Book of Hours, this great 14th century tapestry or illuminated manuscript that has these beautiful images of medieval life. I think they had a range that they were using. Certainly the gowns with their petticoats and paniers and stuff was more 18th century than medieval. And I think it was deliberate that they were when they did those houses, they were kind of those half-timbered draftings of the houses that opened the show. It was something that could have been true for any of three different centuries.
Interesting. My brain was going, oh, well, Rapunzel was living in a 300-year-old tower. And
that works too, doesn't it?
Was brand new.
Because the witch is supposedly hundreds of years old. I mean,
right.
There's some backstory of the witch that they never really spell out, but
yeah.
I feel like, yeah, she's kind of a vampire character.
Right. And then, okay, so then speaking of the witch, so you're saying that the ivy that goes around Rapunzel's tower was actually made of metal and that served as like rungs that she could like climb on to get up.
Yeah. And there was, I can't even remember if it was just profiles in rigid material or if it was soft felt. There was a greenery sort of a leaf design with that metal work. But I remember, because they had to build it in a metal sort of way. So it was very much its own layered drafting. That was a separate page from the drafting that showed the styrofoam carving. The stone face of the tower and that sort of detail, quatrefoil, the specific chateau imagery that was put into that was all carved in styrofoam or bead foam and then hard coated. But then on top of the stone face was this metal layer that was the climbing surface for the stunt stuff.
And was that like a precarious climb, or was it made in a way that was more like a step ladder that would have been kind
of? I'm trying to remember. No, it was organic. It was organic vines that I drew to get up to as far as she was, as far as the window was. I'm sort of reaching back into my. Unfortunately, I have no images of any of my draftings. however. Just on my last trip to New York, we stayed at the Civilian, this wonderful hotel.
Oh, yeah, sure, in Hell's Kitchen,
full of these magnificent models and set designs and stuff. And in one of the little display boxes is, in fact, the model piece from the original 1987 Into the Woods design.
Oh, my God.
So the tower piece is there. You know, it's paper model, but it's painted. And so the first time in, what is it now, 35 years, 38 years, thing, since I drew on it, that I suddenly was able to see it again. I mean, I could watch the video recording of the 87 production. But there was definitely this organic ivy thing that we drew, and it must have been drawn in segments because the tower collapsed in 3 seconds.
Yeah. And what was the inside like? I mean,
I don't remember an inside.
Was it just like a flat that she got behind to be in it that was window?
It was a round cylinder that, you know, is probably 4 or 5 feet diameter at the base, and it stepped down narrower, and it came out of a trap in the floor, and she was seen. I guess there must have been an access ladder up the middle.
It
was a hollow zone. But she was seen perched with her arms on the windowsill of the window in the topmost zone, in the topmost chunk. And I don't think there ever was an interior. I'm trying to think if it rotated around.
Was there a ledge for her to stand on up there other than a ladder or, you know?
Yeah, there must have been. This I have no recollection. in fact, there could have been a whole floor because that segment was the smallest.
Mm.
As I recall, the top section is the smallest, but atop the top section was this very wide parapet, this sort of cornice for the whole thing. And that dropped down into the second level, which dropped down into the first level. I think they had a limitation of just how deep into the below stage space that could go. Where was that? The Martin Beck.
Yeah.
I think that was the limitation. And usually the sub stage is where all the trap room is for all the winches and all the winch cables
operate
the decks. So in all likelihood, there was a limitation. They already knew that the whole stack, all stacked up, could only be whatever, six feet tall. And then that would leave enough room for the hydraulics below it before you hit the ground of the trap room. I think the trap was covered up by, you know, there was this big swinging deck piece.
Yeah.
That sort of pivoted from side to side when you're in the woods. And I think that deck piece covered up the trap for most of the show and swung right when we wanted to expose the trap that out of which the tower could come. And I think it only made two appearances in the whole show or something.
Yeah.
It was a moment, but it was not like it didn't last, you know, that many minutes of stage of playing time.
But it makes an impression. And I mean, was there a sense?
It rotated as it came. That's right. Yeah. So it was a turntable and hydraulics all together.
And was there a sense with any of this that it was sort of like cutting edge or kind of anything kind of groundbreaking? I know that like with other design elements, like some of the materials that Anhold Ward was talking about to be like the witch's fur, it was like kind of the beginning that she later used a lot in like Beauty and the Beast, and you know, that it's kind of become the standard of how that's all done, but it was kind of new then.
It's funny. I'll be honest. I can only speak about it from a spectator seeing the show on stage, from having participated, you know, at Tony's studio for those 2 weeks. There was a sense that the show had not worked in La Jolla. I know that there was sort of, there was no sense that it was going to be a hit in New York either. I think they were excited because Bernadette Peters was there, who had not been there in La Jolla. And I know that they'd rewritten things, but remember, Sunny in the Park was a, you know, critical success, but it was so not a monetary success at all. And coming out of it, there was still half of the people who went said, why did they have a second act of Sunday? And now you're coming to Into the Woods, which again has a false ending at the end of act one, and then a whole second act where everything you thought you knew falls apart. So it was not in any way a surefire, it was a risk. And I think Tony, because he started the show with a very conventional, the etching of the image of the houses and the Cinderella's castle, the beginning of the three images on that drop curtain, and then the built pieces. So it started out very conventionally, but as soon as it got to the woods, Tony was playing with toys that had very little to do with telling you where you were or scenery that you could sort of fall in love with. It was very aggressive. There was a definite Arthur Rackham sense of danger. The woods were full of spikes and thistles and thorns and stuff. So it was a very kind of uneasy to love, unromantic idea of where we were going to live for this show. And then it had that wonderful finale of act one with the giant brocade, sort of wedding dress kind of feel to it, and the false, happy ending. But all of act two is even more aggressively difficult, and the how to present the giant was difficult. And I don't think anybody had a confidence that the tone was this thing and that they had all nailed it. I think everybody was trying, gambling. They were gambling with their visual choices. They're gambling with the tone swings. And all of this, when I was there, it would have been after they'd already gotten basically the design approved with James Lapine, and going to bid would have meant there would be usually about 8 weeks or so before the show would open, or the show would start teching on stage. So it was before rehearsals had started. So there was no sense of, oh my gosh, these great new songs are landing the middle of act two that we didn't know how they'd be. So none of that existed yet. It was only the La Jolla memory and you know, things that were being signed up, but they hadn't seen them in rehearsal yet.
Interesting. That's interesting, especially because just today of all days, I happened to talk with Jacqueline Dankworth, who she's a jazz singer and actress. She was Cinderella in the London production of Into the Woods, but her mother was Cleo Lane,
who
was a witch in the national tour. And Jacqueline said that when Cleo came to see her as Cinderella in that London production, she said, oh, it's not as romantic and beautiful as it was in James Lapine's production.
Got even more hard-edged.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder which production that was.
Jones directed it. It was
the Regent Park production.
This was way before that. This is 1990.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, the Regent Park production was cool too.
It was. That was a gorgeous set. I thought that was that found something, a way to do it that was sort of, I thought that was a superb design. Did you see the revival? The storybook revival? I thought that went in exactly the opposite direction.
Totally. That sort of
went Disney, and I was like, wow, if anything, this is so not Disney.
Yeah.
And I think that was Doug Schmidt. I love Doug Schmidt's design.
Yeah.
I guess
Lapine wanted to try something very different after having done it already.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, so for me too, the very first time I saw any of this together or heard any of the music was when we actually, when I paid money to, you know, sit in the audience for a preview.
They didn't even give you a comp?
No, didn't get a comp. I wasn't there long enough. You know, I'm not listed in on IBDB. I wasn't in the program or anything.
You were in the Playbill. That's how I found you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was in the Playbill. Okay, yeah. So then I misspoke. Well, that's nice. But the free ticket. And it's funny because I was a huge fan of Sunday. You know, I'd seen Sondheim shows since the original Little Night Music.
Wow.
Speaking, because today's Glynis Johns' 100th birthday.
That's right. Happy birthday, Glynis Johns.
Seeing all the tributes. But so my whole career, I was dying to actually work more than 2 weeks on a Sondheim. Of course, never happened. But that was the closest I got.
Well, listen, he's gone, but there'll be many more productions of his shows. It's funny that you bring up Little Night Music, because in some ways, these are two shows that could be done on the same set.
They could be. That's so interesting. And there's also this sense of both of them being, you think you know where you are at the end of Act One, and then you sort of get lost in the haze in Act Two.
Yeah.
And in a way, you kind of feel like they're both a kind of maze.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in a place that you doesn't have an entrance or an exit until you get to the very end. That'd be interesting to see those in repertory. That
yeah, would actually be phenomenal. I'm in. Yeah, how do we make this happen? You can design them.
And with the same cast.
Yeah, that could work, right? Yeah. All right, well, I'll have to start fantasizing about who to double cast from these two shows.
I love that. That'd be great.
There was another set thing I wanted to ask you about, though. I should have written it down.
Did you see the concert production?
At Encores, yeah.
Well, I didn't see it with the original cast. I saw it with sort of the second cast on Broadway proper. Not to misspeak, you know, ill speak a production that everybody was raving about, but I did not understand what the excitement with that one was, except for the cow, which was Milky White was brilliant. But
yes.
I liked the people, but I was like, but they're all just standing in a row in front of a bunch of three steps and an orchestra. So I wasn't on the wavelength that everybody else was when they said, this is the one everybody should see.
Interesting. I mean, I think people really have such fondness for the material. Yeah. And we've had such interesting productions. I mean, after that James Lapine storybook, as you put it, revival in 2002.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was the Regent's Park one that came to Central Park, at the Delacorte. And then there was
the strings.
The Fiasco Theater, which
I only saw pictures of. It was brilliant, brilliant design.
Very interesting and cool and weird. So I think maybe people appreciated just in this case, experiencing it, you know, just the material with almost no production really.
Yeah.
And seeing all the great performers that were in it. But are there other approaches into the woods that you would like to try or see try haven't happened yet?
It's funny because the Arthur Rackham idea, the really deep into the woodcuts, is something that, I mean, in a way, Tony Strages has said jumped off of the woodcut idea into something abstract. But the idea of really going into a deep, layered, almost... wing and drop and sort of netted old school scenic painting with a woodcut visual of a woods, I think is something that would be really interesting to do.
What does a woodcut visual mean?
Arthur Rackham was the illustrator from these 1880s, 1890s Grimm's fairy tales.
Mm.
And his, he drew like Dürer. He drew...
Mm.
Though he was drawing with ink and pen, he drew like those lithographic etchings of the 15th, 16th, 17th century. And the idea of really going deep into that crosshatched etching world, maybe even black and white with barely any color, but that idea of it being illustrative, almost like we think of as scene painted sets, but in a really hard-edged engraving style would be something I'd love to see.
Fascinating.
And it would let the people stand forward because, of course, they're in full color. But the idea of woodcut drawings of the forest and woodcut drawings of the houses and the castle and the locations and stuff.
Arthur Rackham did also Alice in Wonderland, famously. Yeah. Is that a touchstone?
That could be. I'm picturing pictures of him drawing rabbits in the woods and stuff. Maybe it's later, 1900 or so. I know that his was one of the jumping off points for what Tony ended up doing.
Yeah.
But to go even further back into that woodcut illustration thing.
Is there anything else? I mean, it's just so interesting to hear the design for Into the Woods talked about from a designer's perspective, you know, things that we as like fans might have, you know, experienced without necessarily understanding. Anything else that you thought was cool or interesting you want to point out?
Well, it's funny you mentioned the connection to Little Night Music, because the one brilliant thing among many that Boris Aronson's set did was it did the sleight of hand beautifully, where you'd have these panels of birch trees painted on Lexan going by, but the lower 6 feet of those panels was opaque. It was leaves and grasses and stuff, which you don't really realize, so that as they move across on the stage, you could tuck a couple of actors behind one, and as it kept moving, it would reveal two people talking, or it would reveal some furniture, or it would wipe in front of a chaise longue, and as it kept moving, the chaise longue would disappear along with it because the bottom was opaque.
Wow.
Tony did things similar to that in Into the Woods, because he had these series of profile panels that slid to sort of make wipes from scene to scene, exactly like Boris Aronson's panels. And so there was this sense that magic could happen instantly, because anything could appear or disappear because of these hits. And I love that. I hadn't really thought of the connection until you just mentioned what a great repertory season that could be. how similarly that idea of making magic happen with the wiping of those panels it works in both things. I never quite understood why Tony did the decking that he did, that one big hill, which was kind of it blocked a lot of action. It was an odd deck solution. I had I thought to ask him, why are you doing this? It would have been a good conversation piece right now. But then when you saw something like the Regent Park version that had staircases and platforms and walkways and spirals and, you know, ad infinitum, and you sort of saw, oh, how thrilling to sort of be off the ground into the canopy of the trees and the you know, anywhere you wanted to go, you could go. That was sort of a brilliant explosion of what the staging could be like. And I think there was a bit of an earthboundness by having those deck solutions the way they were. As I think about it, it's funny because for a millisecond, I'm a production designer in movies. That's the career I've ended up with. And for a millisecond, I fantasized about trying to go out for the film of Into the Woods, of course. Anybody who's a good designer wants to. So I was starting to think of how to put in real terms the showbiz of the songs. Some of those songs, like The Wolf Has and Baker and His Wife Have, are real showbiz vaudeville sort of numbers. And the thought of how to stage a thing on the rocks going across a brook or something in a tap dance sort of way, or a log over a log over another log, and to sort of be able to do a soft shoe from log to log. But the idea of trying to get showbiz tropes into a wood setting was something that I played with in my head. And because there are parts of Into the Woods that people have not really explored, that vaudeville, the vaudeville of it all. And, you know, some of those, a lot of the songs are vintage Sondheim, but some of them are real pastiches.
Yeah.
Vaudeville numbers, and to sort of bring down the flashing lights and the little drop curtain and stuff, and let a vaudeville be a vaudeville would be a great thing to see. I would cheer that.
Well, this sounds like a Bob Fosse Into the Woods. I'm ready for it.
It could totally be that, or at least a tribute to Broadway, you know, yeah. In its colors.
Yeah, it's funny. In some ways, it seems like maybe subsequent productions move further and further away from that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. And that's okay. It's amazing to me that of all of his shows, that's the show that is like every high school, every elementary school, every summer camp.
Yeah.
Into the Woods. And that I'm gobsmacked by, because I think the songs are really, really challenging.
Yeah.
I mean, do it. Anyone can whistle. That's easy singing, you know, a bunch of townspeople running around. But for it to be this one, that's the one all the you know, Gen Z and millennials know is because that's phenomenal to me. That's shocking.
Well, it's like, it's funny how like public consciousness can be so like short attention span, because it's like merely the fact that it's about these familiar fairy tale characters. If you ask a second question, no, it's very dark, it's very twisted, it's complicated, you might not like it. But if you're just going at face value, it seems accessible more than other shows.
It's like the IP, God help us. Yeah. Is that, and also, you know, all the schools just do first act. So
that's right. Yeah. Into the Woods Junior. Well, and also that the original production was captured so exquisitely with James Lapine directing the cameras to get it, you know, really kind of preserved in its most pure original form. How do you feel that the physical production translates on that video?
I haven't watched it in a long time, honestly. The technology of 1980s video is so, you know, humble compared to what we're used to now. And it's no Hamilton, you know, recording. I think one thing that I remember being bugged by was the performances were still geared towards a Broadway audience and hitting the balcony. So there was not, I didn't feel like Joanne Gleason, yes, but I didn't feel like this subtlest. It felt a little too overtly Broadway acting wise, which you can't get away with because those people were doing their performances eight a week. But I think later videos have started to be sensitive to just for the video, let's take it down.
Yeah.
You know, instead of a 10. But it's still amazing to sort of get those performances recorded. The sets, the lighting never was right for a video.
Yeah.
So, never knew what was back there. You saw this sort of murkiness until the brightest scenes, but what are there, four bright scenes in all of Into the Woods and the rest is murky. So it was not friendly to sort of showing the magic of Tony Stragis's work. But that's okay. I mean, look, the fact that there's an actual record of Sweeney Todd with Angela Lansbury is amazing. But oh, how heartbroken I am that they shot it on the tour, which doesn't have the giant foundry.
Yeah.
Set pieces. So it's like, yes, you have a record, but if only you knew what the Eurus Theater actually had, if only you saw the original in New York, you would see the difference.
Can you say more about when we watched the video of Into the Woods, what we're missing that was there in that original production?
Well, those sets lit the way they were intended to be lit on a Broadway stage. You could get all that nuance in a low level of lighting as a theater viewer. And you could also see Bernadette Peters singing in the foreground and still see all the dappled light in the trees overhead, you know, 20 feet higher. But on TV, the range of lighting is unforgiving. So what's half lit is looks dark on the screen. And also you can't quite see Bernadette Peters in close up and see the dappled light through the trees in the same shot, unless you're, you know, dissolving constantly or something. So that you know, 36 foot by 20 foot image that you get as a spectator sitting in a Broadway house, there's no getting that in the TV screen. And obviously you want to know what their faces are doing. You want to understand the words. So you want to see the performances close up. But then you never sort of see what the rest of the world is around them. You know, I sort of want both. I'm really greedy. So
yeah.
I mean, I think they did have some wide shots and bless their hearts when the Rapunzel's tower rises, you know, spinning out of the ground. It's a nice wide shot and it's like as surprising as it was when we saw it on stage. So those things work beautifully and applause that they shot it.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate that input. And all of this. It's so great to hear from you. And
I'm wondering have you spoken to any other of Tony's assistants? I don't even know if Tony is still with us. Is Tony Strait?
He is still with us, but I have not been able to get a hold of him to do an interview. But if there's anyone else you think from that side that I should reach out to, I would love your input.
I can't remember who. I mean, like I say, there I was on my drafting table with my little parallel rule and my T-squares and my flex curves and stuff, drafting my little thing. And I remember I would leave my drafting pages at night and Tony would have noted this or that on them in the morning, which is always what you want because he lived there, you know, 24 hours. But I can't remember who was next to me. I can't remember who was at the next table. And I do remember the mad factory of the model makers with these weird materials and stuff and you know, spray starts, spray smells and everything. But I was racking my brain and I honestly have no clue who else.
I mean, I can tell you the associate set designer was Richard Jarris.
I'm sorry to say that.
Okay, and the assistants to Mr. Strages were Steve Rundle, Joel Reynolds, James Sandifer.
Oh, James Sandifer, actually knew. He's done some great sets as a set designer.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good to know.
And Linda Lee Burks.
Means nothing.
I know, but James and Linda were billed after you, so maybe they were only there for 1 week.
James Sandifer, I know you can get, he would be in I suppose he's in 829, but he's certainly in 800, he would certainly be somebody I have a feeling he was more, he had more history with Tony than I did. So,
well, this still has been wonderful. So I really thank you. Thank you for listening to Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went Into the Woods on the Broadway Podcast Network. Look out for episode 37 with Ben Wright, the original Jack.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.